Hey there, sports history fan. Arnie Chapman here from the Sports History Network. Now, before you jump into this episode, I wanted to share with you an exciting giveaway we have going on with Home Field Apparel. We have a digital $50 gift card to homefieldapparel.com for one lucky fan of the Sports History Network. All you got to do is head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways to sign up. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways.
The names Charles Comiskey and Ban Johnson are familiar to most baseball fans. Comiskey, the one-time owner of the Chicago White Sox, along with Johnson, are both credited with the founding of the American League. But there was a third person who played a very crucial role in the junior circuit's founding, and he has not been given the credit he deserves. And if Comiskey and Johnson were alive today, I think they would most likely agree. Next, on Sports Forgotten Heroes, we're going to explore the career of the third member of this triumvirate who helped found the American League, Tom Loftus.
This is Sports Forgotten Heroes, a tribute to the stars who shape the games we love to watch and the games we love to play. Stars who provided us with many thrills, but when their time was up, they faded away. We'll take a look back at their spectacular careers, their moments of fame, even if it was just for one season or just one game. And now, here's your host, Warren Rogan.
Hello and welcome to the latest edition of Sports Forgotten Heroes, episode number 86, Tom Loftus. Now, so many of you listening out there certainly have heard of Charles Comiskey. Not only was he the owner of the Chicago White Sox, not only did he play such a crucial role in the 1919 Black Sox story and the hiring of Judge Kennesaw Mountain Landis as baseball's first commissioner, he is one of three men who founded the American League. I'm also certain baseball fans, especially hardcore baseball fans, are familiar with the name Ban Johnson, but just in case you're not, here's a quick summary. Johnson was, for the lack of a better term, appalled at how rough and sometimes violent baseball in the National League was. He wanted an alternative to the National League and to put on a show for fans that was family-friendly. An executive with the Western League, Johnson befriended Charles Comiskey and Tom Loftus, among others, and together they laid the groundwork for what would become the American League. One of the biggest foundations to that groundwork was to place teams in populous cities. So the three worked tirelessly to establish teams in such places as St. Louis, Chicago, Baltimore, Boston, Philadelphia, and Washington, D.C. And today's show will dive more deeply into all of that and the role Johnson played. But I will focus more on the story of Tom Loftus, the forgotten member of the triumvirate who also played such a crucial role in the league's founding. And my guest today is a terrific writer and researcher and a member of the Society for American Baseball Research, John Pregler. John likes to concentrate much of his research in and around baseball that has to do with his hometown of Dubuque, Iowa, and he will also discuss just how Dubuque played a role in the development of the American League as well. First, before we get there, a little house cleaning. Remember, you can follow Sports Forgotten Heroes on Twitter, at SportsFHeroes, where I make daily tweets about the forgotten stars I discuss on the podcast. Follow on Instagram. Look for the Sports Forgotten Heroes page on Facebook. Or check out Sports Forgotten Heroes on the web at SportsFH.com. There you can find out more about my guests, the forgotten heroes I talk about, and so much more. There are also links to more stories and video about these forgotten heroes. and links for you to get in touch with me for questions, comments, or suggestions for forgotten stars you'd like to know more about. Again, that's sportsfh.com. Okay, Tom Loftus. He played such an important role in the founding of the American League, and he was also a very important figure in the formation of the rules by which baseball is played, such as making a foul ball count as a strike. Yep, there was a time when a foul ball didn't count as a strike, and Loftus worked to get that changed, along with tabling the idea of a designated hitter way back in the early 1900s. So, let's get into all of that and more with my guest today, John Pregler. John, welcome to Sports Forgotten Heroes. Thrilled you could join me.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
Hey, you know, what an interesting topic, Tom Loftus. First, tell us how you discovered or stumbled upon Tom.
Well, I'm a lifelong Dubuquer. I grew up in Dubuque, Iowa. And in Dubuque, there were three sports heroes or figures that we always heard about growing up. Charles Albert Comiskey, Urban Clarence Faber, and John Jacob Berwanger. And of course, John Jacob Berwanger was the first person ever selected in the NFL draft and the first person ever to win the Heisman Trophy.
Mm-hmm.
Goes by the name of Jay Berwanger.
Mm-hmm.
Red Faber was a world champion spitball pitcher for the Chicago White Sox, who almost single-handedly won the 1917 World Series for Charlie Comiskey. And, of course, Charlie Comiskey is a Hall of Fame founder, father of the American League, and founder, owner of the Chicago White Sox. And
mm-hmm.
all three had history with Dubuque. And Charlie Comiskey, it turned out, his lifelong best friend was Tom Loftus, who also had history with Dubuque. So as I was researching Charlie Comiskey, I became more and more intrigued by the story of Tom Loftus.
Mm-hmm. And what was it about his story that so intrigued you?
The fact that he was tied to early Major League Baseball and the development of Major League Baseball, and the fact that he was the only Major League manager to manage in four major leagues, different major leagues. So immediately I became curious because I had never heard of Tom Loftus or any of his baseball history. So immediately I wanted to know more.
Mm-hmm. The four major leagues, that would be what? The American Association, the Western League, the American League, and the National League?
He was in the American Association, the Union Association, National League, and the American League.
And the Union Association, I think, only lasted like a year, correct?
Correct. That was in 1884, I'm sorry, and was a single-season league.
Mm-hmm. All right, so here's a big question for you, John. Who is Tom Loftus?
Sure, and that's a big, big question. Tom Loftus was a minor league and major league baseball player. He was a team captain. He was a scout. He was a manager. He was a league organizer. He was a league president. He was a club owner, an all-around baseball magnate, really spanning from 1876 till his retirement in 1904 from the Washington Senators.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, I think it's fair to say that almost every baseball fan, at least those who really look back at the history of the game, know who Charles Comiskey is. And I would venture to say there are several of us out there who are quite familiar with Ban Johnson as well. Why does Tom Loftus, who is regarded as one of the founding fathers of the American League, not get the same recognition as a Comiskey or a Johnson?
That's a very good question. And part of the reason is because of where Tom Loftus lived in Dubuque, Iowa, which was a non-major league city with a small media market. The second reason would be because Tom Loftus retired in 1904, 10 years before the era of Babe Ruth started, and 20 years before Charles Comiskey and Ben Johnson were done with their careers in the American League. And as Charles Comiskey and Ben Johnson started to compete and against each other in the beginning of the 20th century, especially as it got into the 19-teens and after the 1919 Black Sox World Series and they're falling apart, both Comiskey and Ben Johnson were trying to write history and slant it towards their own personal perspective of them being the creator of the American League, when no league is created by any one or handful of people. It takes owners and managers in every representative city and a league president. So it takes a large group of people to form a league.
Mm-hmm. What was it about the game of baseball that Loftus liked so much that he had to make a career of it, especially back then?
Well, Tom Loftus, just like Charlie Comiskey, were always considered to be jolly individuals. They were light-spirited, always in a good mood, always wanted to have fun, and always maintained, I think, their boyish charm and sense of fervor for activity. And baseball, I think, was one of those activities in the 1860s when the in 1870s, when these gentlemen were young men growing up, that really caught their fancy. There wasn't a lot of sports that you could participate in outside of something like horse racing or boxing really it gave you the adrenaline rush. And baseball was one of those things. And I think it captured both Comiskey and Loftus and never let them go.
Mm-hmm. Now, he didn't play much in the way of professional or Major League Baseball. He appeared in just 9 games. He hit 182, but he played a lot of semi-pro ball and maybe some minor league ball as well. But even though he didn't play in the majors for, you know, more than that, really, the true definition of a cup of coffee, maybe even less, what can you tell us about the kind of player he was? What position did he play? What were his strengths and weaknesses? What kind of ball player was Tom Loftus?
First and foremost, he was a leader on the field. And Loftus was one of the early individuals that really started to get into the science of the sport and looking at the relationships of the individual positions with one another, based off of, you know, when a hit is hit to the third baseman, what should the second baseman and the first baseman be doing? We know that Charlie Comiskey has been credited with revolutionizing first base play by moving off the bag. And he started that in 1881, playing for manager Tom Loftus in Dubuque. And so Loftus's strength really was first as a coach and player, and his main position was second base. And so when he started playing semi-pro ball for the St. Louis Reds in the mid-1870s, he was a second baseman and a coach, the team coach. And he ended up starting his Major League Baseball playing career in 1877 with the St. Louis Browns, or Brown Stockings, I should say, in 1877, where he only appeared in a couple of games that season. And then he moved on into another league. We need to remember back in the 1870s, professional baseball didn't really start until 1871 with the National Association of Professional Baseball Players. Mm-hmm. But the first professional baseball league was the National League in 1876, and you had some other leagues that started to pop up immediately after that in 77, 78, and 79 with the League Alliance, the National Association, and the Northwestern League. And so Loftus ended up playing with the Nashville Reds in the League Alliance in 1877 as a second baseman and team captain. And then he played with the Peoria Reds as the manager and team captain in 1878 in an independent league. And it was at that time in 1878 that Loftus ended up meeting Ted Sullivan and Charlie Comiskey of the Dubuque Rabbits, who they played a game against. And Ted Sullivan is oftentimes considered one of the fathers of minor league baseball.
Slight detour here. There were, like you said, several different leagues back then, but the one league that really grabbed hold, obviously, at this point, the National League. Why was it the National League was able to really establish itself and the other leagues sort of went by the wayside?
I think a lot of it had to do with the drive of people like Albert Spaulding and the fact that the National League was able to set up in some of or the majority of the top 10 cities and population in the United States, where some of these other leagues were relegated to smaller cities, not necessarily in Chicago or a St. Louis or a Philadelphia or a Boston or a New York. And so part of that was the struggle. The other struggle with early baseball and really all the way through to the mid-1890s was the fact that the United States would have a major recession or Great Depression once every about 4 or 5 years. And every time that would occur, attendance would be down and these leagues would not survive without fans and fanfare coming in at the gates. So that killed a lot of leagues as much as anything else was the unstable economy of the latter part of the 19th century.
Interesting. Back to Loftus. You know, he only played in the National League or the Union Association for such a short period of time, you know, 8-9 games as a official Major League Baseball player. Why did he give up so quickly, or was it that the teams in the National League wouldn't give him a chance? Why become a coach so quickly or a manager, especially at such a young age? He was only 28.
Well, and back then, there were a variety of other leagues that Loftus would play in. So his playing career extended from 1876, 1877, when he started playing with the St. Louis Reds, all the way through 1884 with the Milwaukee Brewers, when he was a player manager with the Brewers, first in the Northwest League, and then at the end of that season of the Northwest League, the Milwaukee Brewers joined the Union Association. And so we believe right around that time, his arm and some health issues were starting to catch up with him. And so for that reason, he gave up playing, especially as he migrated his Milwaukee Brewers from the Northwest League into the Union Association. The rise in caliber of play, I think, also had something to do with him quitting playing.
Mm-hmm. So he quits playing the game and, you know, he coaches and manages. As a manager in what we refer to or regard as Major League Baseball, he didn't have a winning record. He went he won 454 games and lost 580. His best season came in 1890, his first with the Cincinnati Reds, when he went 77-55. And yet he was regarded as such a a good manager, maybe even a great manager. Can you tell us anything about his managing style, what the game was like, and how perhaps managing a team back in the early days of baseball differs from what we see today?
Sure. And it's a great question. Tom Loftus, part of his strength as a manager was his ability to reorganize a baseball club. Back in the 19th century, when you were a team manager, you were both the field manager as well as the general manager, as well as the chief operating officer. So you were responsible for the ballpark, making sure people came to the games, responsible for finding and recruiting players, getting the players ready, arranging your travel, everything and anything you could think of fell under the responsibility of the manager. And so Tom Loftus, like so many baseball players and baseball owners, more specifically in magnates, was also a businessman. And he owned businesses while he played. And so he brought his business sense and business acumen to professional baseball. So oftentimes when Tom Loftus was hired to come in, whether it was at Cleveland or Cincinnati, or even into the Chicago Orphans in 1900 in the National League, it was generally because the club was in trouble in a variety of ways, both financially and with fan attendance. Loftus was also known as a disciplinarian. Although he was a jolly and jovial person, he was also a strict disciplinarian. And people knew that Tom meant business, but they also knew if they listened to Tom that the club would turn around and clubs would start winning. And so every club he went into, usually the club had a very poor winning record, and he was able to turn them around and get them on a winning streak and reorganize the club. But he never really stayed any place more than 2 years to be able to turn it around and then grow the players into a solid pennant contender.
Yeah, why was that? I noticed that he didn't stay with teams for a long period of time. Why was that?
Tom Loftus and Charlie Comiskey as well both wanted to be owners. The National League, although it has been around since 1876, its assurity in the 19th century was not guaranteed, and we saw that with the American Association from 1882 to 1891, and with its demise and collapse. And then we also saw, the Union Association in 1884 was a professional league that lasted one season. You had the Players League in 1890 mm-hmm. that lasted one season that Charlie Comiskey managed and played in for the Chicago Pirates. So they were always out looking to also get a team of their own that they could control to play the brand of baseball that they knew and loved.
Mm-hmm. Of course, when he was involved in the game, you know, way back when, it was a time of, great turmoil. The game was rough, maybe even violent, and leagues, like we've already said, were coming and going, trying to compete with the now well-established National League. Can you paint a picture for us of what the game was like at the turn of the century, the National League, the American Association, the Western Leagues? What was baseball like back then, and how violent or rough was the game?
Baseball was like any other major industry in the United States in the Gilded Age and in the latter half of the 19th century. It was unregulated. It was cutthroat. It was very much the Wild West. There were a lot of people that were getting rich off it, primarily the owners or the magnates, and everybody wanted a piece of that pie. So you had the National League that started out, that was initially in the 70s and the early 80s, no alcohol in the ballparks, no cursing, things like that. And it was a very straight-laced kind of a gentleman's game, which baseball really started and evolved out as in the early part of the 19th century. And then along came the American Association and Chris Vonderhay of the St. Louis Browns and teams like that, that created what was known as the Beer and Whiskey League in 1882 to bring a more fun brand of baseball that allowed drinking in the ballparks, that allowed gambling in the ballparks, which had been banned by the National League. And so the American Association became quite popular rather quickly, especially in the western part of the country, where you had a lot of German and Irish Catholics who were prone to like to have a alcoholic drink on a Sunday. The American Association permitted Sunday baseball where it was banned in the National League, and in a lot of cities across America, baseball was banned on Sundays. So with the rise of the American Association, they were the first real threat to the National League, and they were competing in a lot of the same cities. And over time, the American Association with the drinking allowed in the ballparks and the gambling, the fans were rather rowdy. And there were a lot of exchanges between fans and players back in those days where they would be vocal and verbal exchanges between fans in the stands and the players. Hmm. They would throw stuff, and there would even be fist fights. And that would also be common on the field. You would have people running into each other or throwing baseballs at each other, the pitcher trying to hit the hitter or trying to spike each other with your metal spikes. And that would then turn into vulgarity and maybe a fist fight on the field. So that was not uncommon. It wasn't every single game by any means, but it was pretty prevalent throughout the 1880s and 1890s. And when Ban Johnson finally took over the Western League in 1894, he set out to change that and to clean up the brand of baseball that was being played within his Western League to really give fans an option if you wanted to bring your children to the ballpark on a Sunday to see a clean, fun game of baseball.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, Tom found his way to the Western League, too. He became, if I follow correctly, he became the owner of the Western League's Columbus, Ohio team. Talk about the interesting ways in which his friendship with Comiskey and Johnson developed, how they met, and how Tom found his way to Columbus.
Sure. Well, Tom Loftus had history in Ohio with the Cleveland Blues of the American Association in 1888, and then the Cleveland Spiders of 1889 when Loftus took the Blues from the American Association into the National League for 1889. And then he went over, and because of the player league commotion in 1890 and the creation of that and the uncertainty in Cleveland, he ended up going to manage Cincinnati Reds in 1890, and he took the Reds into the National League in 1890, where they've remained ever since. And so he managed the Reds for 2 years, 1890 and 1891. Well, at that time, Ban Johnson was the sports editor of the Cincinnati Gazette, and Ban was about 9 years younger than Loftus and became friendly with Loftus. And Loftus liked Ban Johnson. He allowed him to travel with the team on the train, and Johnson would write friendly remarks about Loftus all the time in his articles about the Reg games, calling him Sir Thomas or Tommy Loftus. And I think he looked up to him, especially because of his experience having created the Western League in 1885 and the Western Association in 1888, which Loftus had a role in. And then Loftus got fired when John T. Brush was in his second year of ownership of the Cincinnati Reds, and Brush really wanted Charlie Comiskey. So he hired Comiskey, Loftus's best friend, and Comiskey came in and managed the Reds for 3 years, 82, 83, and 84. And at that time, Comiskey became friends with Ban Johnson as well, and I assume through his relationship and friendship with Loftus. And then in 1894, the Western League was reorganizing and looking for a new president. And Charlie Comiskey urged John T. Brush, who owned the Cincinnati Reds, as well as the Indianapolis Hoosiers of the Western League, to hire Ban Johnson as the league president. And with Comiskey's urging, Ban Johnson was hired as the league president for the 1894 season. At the end of the 1894 season, Charlie Comiskey quit the Cincinnati Reds and immediately bought the St. Paul Saints of the Western League for the 1895 season.
Why?
Why
did he do that?
Because it was his opportunity to finally own a baseball team and become a baseball magnate in a league he believed had the potential to be at the level of the National League. And because he was at the end of his playing career and he just could no longer make it in the National League playing.
So
he decided to purchase St. Paul. That year, Tom Loftus created the Eastern Iowa League and was president of that league and owned the Dubuque Dubs, which was a baseball team that would join the Western Association later on. But they would play Comiskey's St. Paul team games here in Dubuque, Iowa, where Loftus lived. And then the following year, Loftus ended up buying the Comiskey or the Columbus Senators and joining the Western League for the 1896 season. So by 1896, Comiskey, Loftus, and Ban Johnson were together and sitting on the board of directors of the Western League and controlling its future.
So the three of them get together and in the Western League, but they must have had this feeling that they knew they could build something, but it had to be bigger than the Western League because of the cities in which the Western League had franchises. So at what point did they start talking about forming a real sustainable league that could contend with the National League? What needed to happen?
Well, the first thing I think that occurred was I think once Johnson, Loftus, and Comiskey were all on the board of directors starting with the winter meetings of 1896, I think that's when they started to sit down with Matt and Henry Caliglia of Milwaukee, with Jimmy Manning of Kansas City, and other individuals who would make their way to the American League, and started to talk about what would it take, because they saw between 1894, 95, and 96 that their cleaner brand of baseball was attracting more and more fans year after year, and they were starting to see some of their larger cities draw more fans than some of the cities in the National League. And so what they knew they needed to do was to migrate out of cities like Columbus and Grand Rapids and Toledo and move into top 10 cities in the United States in population, like a Chicago, like a St. Louis, or a Cleveland. And so that's really what they wanted to set their sights on. Charlie Comiskey always wanted to move back home and have a team in Chicago. Mm-hmm. I'm sure Tom Loftus always wanted to have a team in St. Louis. And so they started to talk about how do we move into those cities, but they had an issue. And that was the national agreement between the National League, the Western League, and the Northwestern League that prohibited a team from one league moving into a city of another league without the permission of the team in that particular city granting permission.
Mm-hmm.
So if the Western League wanted to move into Chicago, they needed the Chicago National League team's permission to do so. So that was some of the complications that they had to figure out, was how do we get into these top 10 cities when we're really not welcomed?
And we're going to get more into that in just a moment. But first, what do you think of this? Could you say that the roots of the American League were actually developed in Dubuque, Iowa? How is it that Dubuque became such a pivotal or important city in the formation of the AL? Did it?
First off, that's a very astute question, and I do believe that there is a direct lineage from Dubuque, Iowa, and the 1879 Northwest League, which was created by Ted Sullivan in Dubuque, Iowa. And I believe that lineage followed through to 1885 when Ted Sullivan and Tom Loftus created the first Western League. And then that Western League was reorganized in 1888 as the Western Association, that went pretty much uninterrupted all the way up to Ban Johnson joining it as its president in 1894. But it really is Ted Sullivan, Tom Loftus, and Charlie Comiskey that had Ed Prell, who was a sports editor for the Chicago Tribune in 1954, called Dubuque one of the early cradles of baseball. And it's really all the work those three gentlemen did, starting in Dubuque, their first decade in pro ball, and everything they did after that for the remaining three or four decades, that has given Dubuque that moniker. And of course, Dubuque is not, it's one of many cradles of early baseball. There's no one cradle of baseball, but it definitely was one of them because of what happened in 1879 and the people that came out of that team.
Mm-hmm. I think to better understand the formation of the American League, one has to understand the convoluted way in baseball operated, meaning how teams folded, formed, folded, moved, etc. You know, you talked about how Loftus moved from team to team. You know, he went from Milwaukee to Cleveland, Cincinnati, Chicago, Washington, owned Columbus. And you also mentioned St. Louis. That city with the Browns, or the Brown Stockings, really played such an integral part in the whole story. The Browns were a troubled franchise, and they were owned by Chris Vonderay. It was a team and or city that you said Loftus wanted to get his hands on. And like I said, it was key in the formation of the American League. So what about St. Louis? What about the Browns or Brown Stockings?
Well, Loftus obviously had long history with the Browns, but so did Major League Baseball. And Chris Vonderhey, after the collapse of the American Association, took his St. Louis Browns into the National League. And Chris Vonderhey was a very brash German immigrant and saloon owner who helped founded the American Association and was one of its biggest champions. But Chris also liked to spend money. And in the 1890s, he got himself into financial trouble. And that, just like today, when a individual team gets in financial trouble, it tends to bring down the rest of the league and cause financial trouble in the league. And so by 1898, the National League owners were trying to force Chris Vonderhey to sell his St. Louis Browns to some other interested party acceptable to the National League ownership to allow it to be infused with fresh capital to try to save the team, because St. Louis at the time was one of the largest cities in the United States. And so at the time, the National League magnates had decided that one of their own, the owners of the Cleveland Spiders, who were not performing well either on the field or at the box.
Was that the team that once won, I think, like 20 games in a season?
Yes.
Yeah,
Joe Quinn was the manager, and it was the worst baseball season in history, winning only 20 games. That is correct. And Joe Quinn, coincidentally, started his baseball career playing for Tom Loftus and Charlie Comiskey in Dubuque in 1881. And he was manager of the Cleveland team.
But the
Robison brothers of Cleveland wanted to find a new city to move their players to because they just weren't drawing in Cleveland, and they saw the opportunity to purchase St. Louis. Ironically, the Robison brothers actually grew up in Dubuque, Iowa, where Tom Loftus lived when he managed for the Robison brothers back in the 1880s, and now he was going up against them for the St. Louis Browns. The Robison brothers decided that they would try to buy the Browns from Vonderhey. Vonderhey would have nothing to do with it, and he was forced into bankruptcy court instead of selling his team. And that opened the door to Tom Loftus or anybody else outside of the control of the National League to bid on the St. Louis Browns because it was going to sheriff sale.
Okay. What was the status of the Western League, or was it the Western Association at this time? And was it considered, did the National League consider it a threat? How did the National League view the competition at this point?
Well, by this point, the Western League was basically a de facto major league. Even though they weren't in top 10 cities around the United States, they were competing directly with the National League for players. They were, by the late 1890s, several of their teams and cities were drawing better than National League teams and cities. And so they were really competing very well against the National League. And so to be able to declare themselves a true major league, they knew that they needed to get into more top 10 cities, because by that time in 1898 and 1899, they were in Milwaukee, Kansas City, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Detroit, Columbus with Loftus's team, and then Indianapolis and Buffalo. So at that time, most of those cities were top 20 cities, but not top 10 cities. And they needed to get into cities like Washington, Philadelphia, Chicago, Cleveland, Boston, Baltimore, to be able to declare themselves a major league.
All right, John. So there's a lot going on here. And obviously we're talking now about getting into bigger cities, to help build a league that could really contend with the National League. So let's try to simplify this a little for our listeners. What was, I have a couple questions here, and again, we're going to try to simplify this. What was the impetus of the formation of the American League?
Taking on the National League. Okay. That was the primary impetus.
Okay.
Was to be able to go head-to-head with the National League.
As a equal league, a partner league, or a league that would compete and or steal players from the National League to become the better of the two leagues, a bigger league?
Over the course of about 3 or 4 years, it was all of the above. Their desire was to become an equal and to not be joined with, but equal to. But they did not want to get into a baseball war where it would be a war of attrition as they went after the same players in the same player pool. They wanted to avoid that. Unfortunately, that was unavoidable, and so that did occur after the American League declared itself a major league in 1901.
Mm-hmm. And they had some really good money backing it, too. Did any of the teams from the Western League become an American League franchise?
Yes. So in 1899, we had the sale of the St. Louis Browns. Tom Loftus went to bid on it. So the story goes, the Robinson brothers ended up purchasing St. Louis and moving their Cleveland players to St. Louis, which basically vacated Cleveland. And that gave then Tom Loftus the opportunity to move his Cleveland team or his Columbus team into Cleveland for the 1900 season of the American League, which was a minor league season. So the Milwaukee Brewers were part of the Western League and made it into the American League as a minor league, as a major league team in 1901. You also had the Chicago White Sox, Detroit Tigers, and then Cleveland were the only teams that were in the Western League or the American League in 1900 as a minor league that made it as a major league team in the American League in 1901 when the American League declared itself a major league.
Okay. Again, why was the city of St. Louis so important to the formation of the American League?
Because it gave Tom Loftus and Charlie Comiskey and Ban Johnson an opportunity to get into a top 10 city. If they were successful in purchasing St. Louis, then they would be able to utilize St. Louis, the ballpark, and the St. Louis Browns as a team in the Western League. And if they lost St. Louis, then they knew Cleveland would open up and they'd be able to move a team into Cleveland, which was a top 10 city. So either way, they knew that with the sale of St. Louis, they were going to end up moving one of their teams into a major league city.
Mm-hmm.
And so St. Louis was critical in that role.
Mm-hmm. And what about Chicago and Cleveland? And why was there so much jumping around? And by jumping around, I mean Comiskey moved out of St. Louis, Loftus moved, Johnson moved, etc. Why was there so much moving around of owners and franchises?
That's a good question. A lot of times it was chasing the fans and the dollars in order to keep your team afloat. It was a lot of it. And so it was wherever you could find the support No one magnate had the kind of money and the kind of resources to do it on their own. So even if you were a Charlie Comiskey or a John T. Brush and you wanted to move your team from one city to another, you still needed additional financial backers and supporters in those cities. So it was very difficult, but also very necessary to keep your ball club alive. And so ball clubs stayed with owners, not necessarily with a city. And so they got bounced around based off of the financial needs of the league at the time.
So when the American League launched, where was Loftus, where was Comiskey, and where was Ban Johnson?
So in at the end of the 1899 Western League season, Ban Johnson was president of the Western League, and Comiskey owned the St. Paul Saints, and Loftus owned the Columbus Senators. In October of 1899, the Western League voted to change its name to the American League at a meeting in Chicago. And so they went from the regional name of Western League to the nationalized name of the American League. But they knew that they were still going to be a minor league in 1900. But they were in the process of moving Columbus into Cleveland, and Charlie Comiskey desperately wanted to move into Chicago from St. Paul. So in the late fall of 1899, Jim Hart, president of the Chicago Orphans, which would soon become the Chicago Cubs, who had been a good friend of Tom Loftus's, had been trying to get Loftus to come manage the Chicago Orphans after Cap Anson left in 1897. But Loftus kept on saying, no, I would not. And Loftus and Comiskey both wanted to manage in a major league city and in a major league in the worst way. Finally, Hart convinced Loftus that if you took the Chicago National League manager job, he would permit Charlie Comiskey to move his Chicago or St. Paul Saints into Chicago and for the 1900 American League season. So Tom Loftus actually agreed to that, and for a brief time, in 1900, Loftus was the manager of the Chicago Orphans in the National League while still owning the Cleveland American League club.
And the Orphans, if I'm not mistaken, they're now the Cubs.
Yes, that is correct. I was going to say they changed their name from the Chicago White Stockings after Cap Anson left. They changed their name to the Orphans because they felt they were orphaned by Anson.
And then, of course, another team comes into Chicago and becomes the White Sox.
Correct. An interesting story there. Hart agreed to Comiskey moving in, but he could not use the name Chicago, so he called his team the White Sox, even though the National League Chicago team had used the name White Sox for almost two decades or three decades.
Interesting. While all this is going on, what's the National League thinking?
They're nervous. And at the time, they were seeing loss in revenue. They were seeing loss of their players to the American League and the Western League. And they did not want to get into a battle of attrition financially going after each other's players. So they were rightfully nervous. And in 1899, before the Western League changed its name to the American League, the Robison brothers, who owned Cleveland and had bought St. Louis, John T. Brush, and Jim Hart, all of the National League were close friends with Charlie Comiskey and Tom Loftus. And they started meeting privately within the National League and then with the Western League magnates, Johnson, Comiskey, and Loftus. And it's believed that they struck a deal in mid-1899 to consolidate their leagues because the National League had 12 teams and it really needed to pare down to eight. And the Western League had six teams and they were looking to expand. And so it's believed and most indications are from newspaper articles that the National League and the Western League had agreed to go ahead and join forces because at the time there was a effort to revive the American Association to take on the National League as a rival major league. And that scared the National League more than the Western League did.
So the National League, in a way, was a part of the formation of the American League. And a lot of that was because they really felt threatened.
Absolutely, and it was out of self-preservation. And it was because of the backroom deal of Robison, Brush, and Hart with Loftus, Comiskey, and Johnson that allowed it to happen. Now, other National League magnates were not as happy with it, and so as soon as it had occurred in 1901 when the American League was able to declare itself a major league in competition with the National League because it had moved some more of its teams into top 10 cities. They had moved Kansas City into Washington to become the Washington Senators. They moved the Minneapolis team to Philadelphia to become the Athletics. And Buffalo went to Boston to become the Boston Americans. And then the Indianapolis Hoosiers moved to Baltimore and became the Baltimore Orioles for the 1901 season. And unfortunately, much to everybody's desires otherwise, 1901 started a baseball war that would rage on for 3 years.
And can you expand a little bit on that war? What was it? I mean, you had two leagues, the American League and the National League, that, well, the National League agreed that there needed, you know, the American League should become a real league, a league that could contend with them. But you'd say that there was a war between the two leagues. So I find that really interesting in that they sort of helped each other out. And of course, the World Series wasn't yet formed and it wouldn't be for a couple more years. So what was the war? Why was there a war?
Because with the American League now in a lot of the same cities that the National League was playing in, they were not only in direct in competition nationally for general fans, but they were in direct competition in every single city for fans at the gate. And so that led to a bidding war for players that got really out of hand. They were reluctant partners to begin with. It was a matter of self-preservation, the National League getting into bed, as it were, with the American League to stave off the American Association from rising up and taking them on. They feared the American Association, which was being led by John McGraw, Cap Anson, Al Spink of the Sporting News, Ted Sullivan, and other baseball men. So the National League really favored the American League over the American Association. Mm-hmm. And so they placed their lot with them. But by 1903, they really started realizing that this war of attrition could not go on and that they needed to come together and create a new national agreement. When the Western League changed its name to the American League and reincorporated in 1900, it basically removed the Western League from the national agreement. So they were able to now also do certain things that they were not able to legally because of that contract between the Western League and the National League.
Right.
And so in 19... 19-
yeah. Yeah, go ahead. No, you go ahead. We're probably heading in the same direction here.
Sure. I was going to say, so in 1903, they recognized the need for a new national agreement. Towards the end of the city, the American League and National League agreed to get together and have a conference to iron out a new national agreement.
Right, and that's where I was going. What role did Tom Loftus play on the committee, and how did he help bring the two leagues together?
So the National League and the American League each got to appoint three individuals to a rules committee and to a schedules committee. And the American League appointed the same three people, including Tom Loftus, to both the schedules and rules committee. And then the National League had different individuals on each committee, with the only consistent person being Jim Hart, the good friend of Tom Loftus. So they were able to sit down and iron out an agreeable schedule between the National League and the American League. Two of their concerns were they didn't want the National and American League team from the same city playing on the same day in their hometown. They wanted one out of town to help increase the fan draw for each team, mm-hmm. So they weren't competing in that manner. So that was one of the considerations. The other was that they wanted opening day to be on the same day for both leagues. Mm-hmm. And they were able to hammer that out with no contention or no issue. Mm-hmm. Then the other committee was the rules committee, and there was definitely some work to be done, because throughout baseball history up to that point in time, every league had its own set of baseball rules. It was not necessarily uniform, and there were a variety of things that still needed to be decided between the two leagues to standardize it to make it a true major league, mm-hmm. Singular major league.
I think one of the interesting things about that, the rules committee, this is way back in 1903, they actually considered a designated hitter. And here we are today, still talking about, should we or should we not have a designated hitter in both leagues? And of course, this year, we do. But Tom Loftus played a key role in a few other decisions. One included not striking out on a foul ball. Can you talk about the couple of rules that Tom played such a key role in establishing?
Sure. So one of the rules in baseball for the longest time did not exist was the foul strike. So you could foul off as many foul balls as you wanted to, and it would not count against you. So if you didn't have any strikes, you could foul off 10 straight pitches and still not have any strikes against you. And that would cause games to go on forever.
Hmm.
So the proposed rule was that if you do on your first and second foul tip, if you do not have a strike, it would count as a strike, but a foul ball would not count as a third strike. And Tom Loftus went into the meeting. He was for the rule, but the American League was against the rule. It was more of a National League rule. But Tom acquiesced because he also had wanted to get a clearer definition of the balk rule. And he also was very interested in establishing a standard height for pitchers' mounds. There was no standard height in baseball, so they limited it in the 1903 National Agreement. Then the other thing that Loftus did was he was able to get them to do away with raising the foul lines, base lines. Several teams and groundkeepers for teams that like to bunt would raise the dirt along the base lines, so bunts would roll fair.
Hmm.
And that was not necessarily consistent around the league. And so he wanted it so that it was always flat and that the pitcher mound had a consistent slope and could not go over a certain height. And he was successful in getting those rules implemented.
Mm-hmm. So he has really spent his entire life in the game of baseball, and he finally helps to bring these two leagues together. How exhausting was all of this for Tom Loftus? You know, why did he decide to step away from the game so soon after all of this work to bring the two leagues together?
Well, after his stint with Chicago, there he went on to be part owner and manager of the Washington Senators. And that was in that 1902-03-04 time frame. And around that time, more and more of the power was being taken away from the owners of the teams, and the control that they had over their players, over their ballparks, and over their assets. And more it was being controlled by the league president. With the baseball war there that went on in 1901, 2, and 3, that had taken a toll on Loftus's health. Loftus also owned businesses outside of baseball, which is where he got his money to own and support his baseball teams that he owned. And so he wanted to refocus on his businesses as well. So at the beginning of the 1904 season, he decided to step down from the Washington Senators and sell his stake and retire from baseball.
Mm-hmm. Did he ever try to get back into the majors?
He had an opportunity in 1905. Ban Johnson and Comiskey had a team available for him, although I have not been able to identify what team it is. All Loftus had to do was say he wanted back in, and it was his. He opted not to. In 1908, though, he did agree to become the president of the Iowa, Illinois, Indiana, the 3I mm-hmm. minor league, mm-hmm. In an effort to save that league. It was going to go under, and he came in, reorganized it, and allowed that league to live on. But he did that only for the 1908 season, and that mm-hmm. was the last season he had contact with baseball.
Yeah, he died at a pretty young age, 54. Why don't we know, and I think I asked you this to start off, but why don't we know more about Tom Loftus?
Yeah, again, I think it's because he bowed out. He wasn't after the glory, the fame, or the print in the newspaper. Tom did it for the love of the game. I truly believe that. You know, he was quiet. He didn't like making a big scene. He wasn't overly boisterous like a Charlie Comiskey was. I think that played a lot into it. And he was well known and well respected throughout the first part of the 20th century. But as some of those older guard, you know, passed away and those types of things, he slowly became forgotten.
Mm-hmm. What should we remember about Tom Loftus?
That he was a great builder up of the game of baseball, our national game, at every level. He lived, breathed, and delighted in the game of baseball at every level, whether it was children, whether it was the minor leagues, whether it was the major leagues. Tom was always 110% behind getting out and playing the game and really loving the game. He believed it built character in men, and it was also good for the soul because of the exercise. And Tom was very, very well respected by all the giants of the game, whether it's George Wright or Harry Wright or Charlie Comiskey or Cap Anson or King Kelly. So many of the great players and names of the 19th century had nothing but good things to say about Tom Loftus.
Hmm. Is he given enough credit for his role in the formation of the American League? And why are Comiskey and Johnson given more credit?
That's a very good question. And the answer is no, he's not given enough credit. And I believe that Comiskey and Johnson are given more credit again because they lived 20 years longer. And, you know, baseball really took off, you know, after the dead ball era and with the era of Ruth. And that was post Tom Loftus. Comiskey and Johnson were still part of that early Babe Ruth era, post dead ball era. And they were able to get more of the print, more of the spotlight, more of the dime store novels written about them.
Mm-hmm. You know, I've done this on several occasions, and let me first say it this way. I'm not stumping or, you know, saying that someone should or should not be in the Hall of Fame, but should Tom Loftus be in the Hall of Fame, at least as a builder?
I think so. I think first off, we need to look at what qualifies for being in the National Baseball Hall of Fame. It has to be more than just MLB as we know it today. There is a national baseball history with people like Tom Loftus, with people like Bud Fowler, who desperately should be in the Hall of Fame, and hopefully he gets in this year finally, that just don't get the recognition they deserve because they never played in Major League Baseball as we define it today.
Mm-hmm. You know, John, you know so much about this topic. It's actually incredible. And I want to thank you so much for being my guest on Sports Forgotten Heroes. This hour went really quick for me. And it's just, it's amazing that I know Charles Comiskey and Ben Johnson, and yet someone who played as crucial a role in the formation of the American League and really in the formation of Major League Baseball, Tom Loftus, is just not better known.
Yeah, it's a shame. And unfortunately, there's a lot of our 19th century baseball history that we are unaware of. And there's probably two or three dozen more people just like Tom Loftus whose stories deserve to be told.
Agreed. John, thank you so much. And if you ever tell one of those stories, you got to let me know so I can get you back on Sports Forgotten Heroes.
We'll definitely do. Thanks for your time, Warren.
Awesome. Thank you. Like I said, I don't campaign, nor was this podcast created for the purpose of campaigning for someone's induction into the Hall of Fame. But when you consider just how important a role Tom Loftus played in the founding of the American League, and the fact that Charles Comiskey and Ben Johnson were both enshrined, it leaves you to wonder why Loftus has not received the same honor. But, like John said, fair or not, it probably has to do with the fact that Loftus left the game so soon after he helped found the league, and because he had no one to carry on his legacy. So, while Tom Loftus is not a member of the Hall of Fame, I am certainly grateful to John for coming on Sports Forgotten Heroes so we could talk about Tom Loftus and do our part to keep his legacy alive and let everyone who listens know just how important Tom was to the founding of the American League, as he played just as big a role as Charles Comiskey and Ben Johnson. Next time on Sports Forgotten Heroes, in case you didn't see it just a short time ago, a fan favorite from the downtrodden years of the New York Yankees passed away, Horace Clark. And I'm going to talk about his career and more. That's next time. For now, thanks to John Pregler for joining me, and thanks to all of you for listening, and I'll see you next time on Sports Forgotten Heroes.
Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Each week, the official Football Learning Academy podcast will take you deep into the history of pro football through interviews with players, coaches, or administrators in the NFL, as well as interviews with Pro Football Hall of Fame selectors, authors, and historians. You'll learn how the game evolved and important moments that shaped the sport into what it is today. And don't miss the Pro Football History Nugget of the Week. Listen to the official Football Learning Academy podcast on the Sports History Network.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcast. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcast. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.